KUMD recorded the first Ulrich International Lecture this fall at UMD. Tonight we share a lecture called The United Nations at 70 and Counting, an analysis of the UN by a leading expert, Dr. Thomas Weiss, Presidential Professor of Political Science and Director Emeritus of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies.
First, let me start by thanking Royal and Karen for making it possible for me to come here. We had a good conversation, but it was interrupted yesterday evening. And Royal, you mentioned your mother was a supporter of the UN, and it's obvious almost everybody who lived through World War II thought that it was important to do something after the Second War to end all wars. And you asked me how I got interested, and before I could answer, we were interrupted, somebody came in. And the same question was asked of me on the 70th anniversary last October in London when I was on a panel on the wartime UN. And I gave the response that actually coincides with what Tom and I discussed earlier with internships, that in fact it was an internship at the International Labor Organization that actually launched my career. There was a chapter in my dissertation, and on and on. And suddenly, in mid-sentence, I stopped, and I realized that, in fact, I had been conceived while the San Francisco Conference was on and born while the General Assembly was opening in London. So all I can figure out was it was in mother's milk, because there's not any other explanation. Anyway, I'd like to do four things, I hope, this evening, and then leave about a half an hour for discussion at the end. The first is my own journey as a back-of-the-envelope historian, having started out as a political scientist. The second is I want to go back and revisit the insights from wartime United Nations from 1942 to 1945. The third thing is trying to put that in a contemporary context and why that pragmatic idealism really made a difference then, and it could make a difference now. And then finally, to say why the path we're currently on, global governance, and I've had something to do with writing about that, but how good enough global governance ain't good enough. So that's where I'd like to end up. Social scientists are ahistorical. What we tend to do is extrapolate from the last few months into this morning's headlines. And two projects I've been involved in the last 10 to 15 years, one, the intellectual history of the United Nations, and the second, which is more important for this evening, called the wartime history of the UN, have suggested that it's important to go a little farther back. I wasn't sure whether, Cindy, during the courses early in the week, I was boring people by going back to the League and to the early years of the UN. But I reminded people that, in fact, 2014 was the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, the 75th of World War II, 2015 was the 200th anniversary of the end of the Napoleonic Wars, which coincided with the UN's birthday. The fact that wars seem to be necessary to lead to experiments and international organization is a kind of a depressing realization. But it is the currency of institutional reform. So while these are artificial hooks, I wanted to take the opportunity of the 70th anniversary to look back. Because in fact, in a conversation I had with Tom the other day, I said that one of the tragedies, frankly, of the end of the Cold War is that no new rethinking of organizations occurred. We simply heaved a huge sigh of relief. Thank God that's over, and left all of the institutional structure as it was. So, currently, Royal, your mother wouldn't be happy that the UN is an afterthought, if a thought at all. And in fact, an even more interesting experiment, the European Union, is also under threat. So multilateralism is not the currency of the day. So, you know, I look at these issues, and what I see is a whole series of issues. World War II and World War I were about interstate conflict. Now we've got a host of other issues that are equally threatening. It's hard to think about anything more threatening existentially than climate change. But we can tick off pandemics, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, global financial instability, and the list goes on. So we got more threats. The demand for international organizations is going up. And the supply remains anemic, not the numbers, but the authority of these institutions. So there's a growing disconnect between the things that threaten us and the machinery and the decision-making and the way we mobilize resources to solve them. So we get an occasional tactical short-term solution instead of sustained strategic and longer-run global perspectives. So why do I really want to go back to 1942? I think most people don't realize that the United Nations began on the 1st of January, 1942, the signature of something called the Declaration by United Nations. 26 countries, joined quickly thereafter by 18 more, formed an alliance to crush fascism, yes. But it was also a mode of operations which required collaboration. Obviously, big powers and important powers had more to say than smaller ones, but the standard operating procedure was cooperation, not conflict among these ideas. So, strangely, the ideals of Kant, if you were to be essential to the Hobbesian project of survival. So my bottom line here is that when governments decide to use intergovernmental organizations, they work. I had a question the other day, well, what about Syria? Perhaps the most clear example of a recent failure by the Security Council to do anything. So, it's a total flop. Or, when the same member states earlier had decided that weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons in Syria, were a step too far, the same inept countries made a decision to get rid of those. And there was only one institution that could do that. So, is it not worth having around, or occasionally worth having around? I opt for the latter. But this talk will sort of fly in the face of what I see as a contemporary infatuation with everything except intergovernmental organizations, non-governmental organizations, civil society, local groups, transnational corporations. Much of this was started about 10 years ago by Anne-Marie Slaughter, who pointed to networks of governmental legal folks in particular, but other economists and politicians as the answer to the future. Dan Dresner at Tufts and Stuart Patrick at the Council on Foreign Relations basically point to a hopeless and hapless UN, but they say, we've got all these NGOs, we've got all these corporations. This will be good enough global governance. Well, alas, no matter how many NGOs, no matter how many corporations are around, this coherent pluralism or institutional sprawl is not going to address the problems that preoccupy many of you and certainly preoccupy me. And so the same, well, not the same number, but the same states, the same civil society, and many of the same corporations during World War II thought very, very differently. As I said, it was a short-term alliance to crush fascism, but it was also a commitment to the post-war years that stability, peace, and prosperity required some of the same tactics and certainly the same strategy that they had used during the war. I said the other day that one of the striking things about this conference in October last year in London, it was located in Russell Square, a terrific place. But if you're in Russell Square and look around, there are lots of really ugly buildings and lots of really charming buildings. And you suddenly realize that all of the ugly ones, or maybe you'll disagree with my architectural taste, but many of the ugly ones were all built as a result of the bombing of World War II. And the people who were sitting around Russell Square were thinking about the future. They weren't only thinking about the Blitz. So if you look into the archives, I'm going to start with a quote by Roosevelt, who said, "We mean business in this war in a political and humanitarian sense just as surely as we mean a military one." He was addressing the first United Nations operational organization for relief and rehabilitation. Intriguingly, this is still the world's largest humanitarian operation, even though a recent Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, said, "We don't do social work." Well, in fact, a lot of World War II, 42 to 45, was social work. The United States, there were two budgets for UNRWA. The United States contributed 1% of GDP without asking any questions. And that multilateralist Dean Acheson was behind this. It's really quite intriguing. Now, we argue about 0.7% of GDP, which is a target for development assistance. We don't sign on to that. In fact, current U.S. Contribution is around 0.1%. So, this was going on. The same time, the UN Information Office was not trying to do U.S. public diplomacy and trying to say what great values need to be transmitted overseas. The UN Public Information Office was taking the message about the necessity for international action and cooperation to the U.S., to Britain, to India, to China, etc. So that was the UN Information Office. The Food and Agricultural Organization, wasn't called that yet, but the people leading up to it, were talking about eliminating hunger. The International Labor Organization, Roosevelt shows up and proposes decolonization within 5 years, not exactly making our British friends happy. There were war crimes tribunals, the UN War Crimes Commission, which did not just, Sasha, you mentioned Nuremberg and Tokyo yesterday evening, didn't go after a handful, 20 and what, 19 in the Nuremberg, 25 or 6 in Tokyo, but there were 36,000 indictments. These were not just the people at the top. They were foot soldiers in 17 countries who were responsible for rape and other war crimes. So all of these experiments were run by the United Nations and were supposed to continue. So the kind of routine thinking was totally different. And in fact, the best example I've come up with, well, actually it was a friend, Hans Singer, who now has died, who was an early UN official and then taught at Sussex thereafter, pulled out some documents from John Maynard Keynes, who showed up at Bretton Woods. And this is to demonstrate the layer of thinking and the kind of sort of forceful thinking that was on the line. He said, "We need," wasn't called the International Monetary Fund, but "we need a monetary thing that has the equivalent of reserves of 50% of world imports." The American assigned to throw cold water, Harry Dexter White, said, "Oh, that's ridiculous. How about 15%? The International Monetary Fund, which is supposed to be one of the most robust and sometimes people say overstretching of international institutions, after the infusion of about $1 trillion in 2008, had less than 2% of world imports. So what we now consider as outlandish is 1/25th of what the 20th century, or arguably the 20th century's best economists thought was necessary. So this shrinking back from the brink is a story that has not, I think, been told enough. So the idea that the United Nations was only a military victory ignores the archival record, and ignores what's going on in foreign ministries worldwide in 44 countries. So, the United Nations was not a liberal toy to be tossed away, but it was actually a combination of a realist necessity with some idealism. It was not peripheral, but central to international relations. And if you look at the record at what people who were thinking, the Carnegie Corporation sponsored a whole series of meetings, but there were foreign ministries worldwide, and when you pull together the documents from these, which I've done with a series of colleagues and looking at what was going on behind the scenes, no one was actually thinking about, let's do 1914 backwards or minus. Let's do 1918 plus. So even though the League, the predecessor of the UN, fell flat on its face, there were many elements, minorities treaties, refugee organization, economic research about the problems during the Depression, an international civil service that was committed to something besides national interest. All of these were taken, transplanted, and the idea was the subtitle of this talk might be the, as I said, good enough global governance ain't good enough. An ironic obstacle at present, and I see myself and some of my colleagues responsible for this, is that the study of international organization, the study of international law, is not all that fashionable. We have a complex world, and an enormous amount of intellectual firepower is going into trying to understand the non-state actors. And while, as I say, I do not want to indicate that that is useless, I spent a lot of my time looking at non-governmental organizations, UN contributing to UN efforts in war zones. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out global social responsibility for corporations. But the pendulum has swung way too far. The idea that there is, as I said, an afterthought for intergovernmental organization is one that does not bode well for the future. This contrasts so strikingly with the thinking during World War II that I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how we go back to the future. Because I see it as almost as a moment of the sort of pinnacle, if you will, of international cooperation on the kinds of issues that are critical to human survival. If you look at the record, it suggests that sometimes the conditions are right. Johnson would have talked about hanging and focusing the mind, and I guess World War II helped do that. But the idea that it's essential to move beyond the navel gazing of narrowly defined national interests to, if you don't want to call it cosmopolitanism, to something that redefines state interest in terms of something beyond the borders of a single state. Especially because all of the problems we're preoccupied with, certainly no state, this one or any other one, can attack on its own. So, the universal membership United Nations is seen as unequal to the task. And while I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make it better, it is still a critical part of the picture that is not at all central to any academic or policy thinking. Mentioned Royal, there has been a single mention in any primary debate, Republican or Democratic. In 2008, it was mentioned once. In 2012, it wasn't mentioned at all. As I say, this is on no one's radar screen. And not to put too fine a point on it, even though I want to mobilize the resources of the private, the for-profit private sector, the not-for-profit sector, all hands on deck are certainly welcome. It's kind of silly to think that activists crossing borders, that transnational corporations, that the media are going to halt mass atrocities, are going to halt climate change, are going to stop the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. This just is wishful thinking. So the under-resourced, the understaffed, the under-politically supported by poor political will organizations that constitute that contemporary system have limped along rather than thrived. And it seems to me that a strategy for the future is going to involve building on the non-state contributions, scaling those up, making them more robust, but at the same time, states and everyone else is going to have to recommit to intergovernmental organizations, or we're going to be in deep trouble. So I'm going to sort of end up more or less where I started. Must the next generation of multilateral organizations arise as the result of an unnecessary and unspeakable tragedy? That's the common currency for institutional form. I'd like to think that maybe we've learned something, that maybe we can attack these issues, that maybe we can move beyond the borders of a single state. The human capacity to do that exists, and it seems to me that looking back on this record is a real source for me, anyway, of motivation, of optimism. These ambitious, really ambitious visions that came out of not utopians, but by people in the midst of war dealing with the nuts and bolts of the conflict, but thinking about the future. And it seems to me that that more muscular intergovernmental organizations with wider scope, more resources, and better political support are going to have to be part of the future.
Listen Monday nights at 7 for lectures from the Allworth Institute for International Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth. More information at KUMD.org. Thank you for listening here on KUMD Duluth Public Radio.